Vince Lancy, welcome to The Competent Investor. Thanks for joining me.
Thanks for having me on. I'm very excited and happy to be here now that you've ventured out on your own, and I look forward to seeing you interview everyone, all of our favorites, and doing it here. Thanks for having me. Congratulations, by the way.
I really appreciate that, Vince. And of course, you know, you and I have formed a good friendship over the years of chatting and kind of getting to know each other. And you know, I've really appreciated all of what you've taught me, and I think it's absolutely invaluable to the listeners as well. So, you know, I appreciate all of your work that goes into that. And, you know, yours is, you know, let's say a source of information that I read and listen to quite often. Mm-hmm. And I've noticed over the last little bit that there's been especially there was one day, I would say last week, where there was like a meaningful shift in your tone. Is there something, let's say, particularly that you're worried about within the markets or the broader economies of the world that is, you know, starting to actually manifest in more than just, you know, us being happy that the gold price is going up?
Yeah. About 8 or 9 days ago, I woke up and gold was like, you know, another $70 higher or whatever it was. And, you know, I'm counting my money and I'm having a good day and I'm going, okay. And then I start saying, but why? What the hell's going on here? Why are they letting it? And so I started to treat gold as what it is. It's a predictor of the future. Or it didn't always used to be a predictor of the future over the last 20 years, but it is again now. So, I woke up that day really, really concerned. And it's because before that rally that night, I had a couple conversations with different people. And I had these pieces of the puzzles that were coming together to give me my next directional trade. Like if I think it's going to go up or down or buy stocks or whatever, you know, just trying to figure out the story. The first conversation I had was with a colleague of mine on the mainland in China. And I had noticed coming out of the BRICS meeting, the BRICS summit, mm-hmm. that there really wasn't a lot to grab onto publicly, but I had grabbed onto the vaults, which have proven to be true. And so far anyway. And so I reached out to him and I said, you know, there are two things that I noticed. One was they were liberalizing, they were coming out of the box a little bit more hard with their liberalizing ownership of gold. So the vaults, the projecting price out of the country. And I also noticed, because we talk about these things, I said, look, when Shanghai traders are buying gold, that's really China. And, you know, he agreed with me on that. So when a Chinese bank buys gold, that's because they've been given permission to by the Chinese government. And so I said, you know, is there anything going on? This is before I had that wake up panic, you know? And he goes, I'm not sure, but I think that they're losing patience. They have been waiting. The sentence goes like this. It goes like, I'm like the Chinese to English, like, you know, a little bit gets lost. I'm trying to make it fluent or fluid. Yeah. He said, they have been patient for a long time, and recent events with Trump are making them less patient. They have to move their timeline up a little faster. That may be what they're doing. So, because he's been very reliable and very knowledgeable, I went, maybe I should buy more gold. Like, I mean, I didn't do that. I was thinking about, you know, I think, let me see if gold goes up. And sure enough, it started to move. And this was two other things were happening around the same time. And you and I were discussing this beforehand. One was Trump's rhetoric to China had escalated. And what I had noticed is over the 2 weeks prior, China was pushing back. They weren't pushing back rhetorically. They were just saying, fine, then we'll do this. Fine, then we'll do that. They had an answer for everything Trump said. Mm-hmm. They had an answer for everything. And it was policy change, policy change, policy change, moving on. Like, they really weren't provoking him. but they were doing actionable things. And the second thing is, out of nowhere, it looked like Trump was picking a fight with India. Now, there's probably a lot going on behind the scenes. India probably was already leaving the nest, so to speak. And so Trump was, you can't quit, you're fired type of thing. Who knows? But the point is, you and I both discussed this. India hanging out at the Shanghai Cooperative Meeting, SCO. India's over there shaking hands, being buddy-buddy. And I'm like, my God, what's going on here? And around that same time, gold started to run. And I had this from my buddy in the mainland, my CCP expert, who just makes me feel like I'm on the inside, but he just knows markets. And then I have this behavior that I'm observing. And then I wake up one morning and gold's higher. Now, and I had here's the last piece. I'm sorry to bore you with this, but here's the last piece that made me I had a panic, right? I had an American patriot panic. I know what we have to do, or what Trump is trying to do. And it's something that Michael Hartnett will talk about a lot, but it's real simple. We can't afford a recession. We need to rebuild manufacturing. We need to have other ways to support our debt without borrowing from someone else. And you put all those three things together, we need to make things and export them. Fine. And that's what Trump's been doing. The whole Make America Great Again and the One Big Bet. And I started going through the pieces that he was putting out there. And I went, okay, that's like, I could just see other people giving him the information because I know what he wants, but tactically he was doing the right things. And I'm like, okay, that's good. That's good. Like, he's doing CapEx deductions for technology and manufacturing, but that's good. And I went, I said, okay, so basically we have to create a bubble. We're creating a bubble, meaning you can't afford a recession. And stocks started climbing again. And this time gold's climbing with them. I'm like, Jesus, something's going on here really bad. And then China comes out and says some things. If we could do it cheaper than they can, you guys just spent $600 billion on Starlight or Stargate or whatever it's called, and we could do it for $10 million. And I'm like, okay, all right. So China's trying to push our stock values down and pump their stock values up. At the same time, we're trying to refurbish our economy. And it dawned on me with all this other stuff I just told you that, oh my God, suppose China is losing their patience. Like, we're going to be in economic war. I don't have enough gold. Like, I was, I became a gold bug. I also became a depressed American because it was at this moment that Trump said, we're going to tariff gold in Switzerland. And I'm like, wait a minute, that's stupid. You can't do that. You're tariffing money. Like, and it turns out we're not going to do that. But the point is, you don't even lead with that. You upset your own financial balance sheet. Anyway, short story long, I guess, right? I woke up and I said, the epiphany was, we're not going to do it. We're not going to get it done in time. If China decides to change their mind and go faster, we're screwed. Like, I really felt like they were in control at that moment. And upon feeling that, I started looking for behavioral patterns in the market. And sure enough, around that same time, macro discretionary, the big funds that look 2 months to 2 years out, they started buying again. And I went, oh boy. So I'm going to make a lot of money and I'm probably going to be dead in 6 months, something like that. And so I did a couple pieces on that, saying that we can't afford to fail. This is where we are. The Fed can't offload its balance sheet, all kinds of things. I mean, you'll have to direct me back to specifics, yeah, I the gold's price got silly. It's getting silly. It is silly. And here's the thing, you and I were talking about off the air beforehand. Where's the pushback?
It's being permitted to now go to its natural level.
Right. And then right about that time, the bank started coming out saying, we like gold at 4,000. Well, I like gold at 5,000. Well, I like gold at 6,000 JP Morgan last week. And I went, okay, I know when the banks are pumping so they can sell out, but this was too much. Mm-hmm. Like, and for JP Morgan doesn't come out with these type of proclamations. And I started to get, you know, like, maybe they're trying to get ahead of something. Maybe there is some news. So, you know, gold standard, gold bonds, what have you. But really, it's more like China's escalating or China's pushing back. And I got nervous, and I'm nervous, you know. And of course, that was good because I let my profits run. But I got nervous, and I've been very tactical with my trading lately. So I mean, I'm not really saying much meat except to say, I mean, I really poured it out the other day, and I went searching for an item that could be happening that's not going to get us all killed, mm-hmm. And I did stumble on something, and that was the HQLA thing. And so I believe I know what's going on now. And from conversations with other people, I've also talked to Eric Young, and he had a piece of the puzzle that I was missing, and I put it together, and we had a conversation about it. And I'm happy to say that I think I know what's going on, or at least enough of what's going on, why gold's going up. So do you want to get into that or something else?
No, absolutely. Like, I think it's helpful as well to kind of be talking through how you're, you know, like really your emotional state as you're going through this and learning all of these things, because I think a lot of us in this space are doing the same thing. You know, you wake up one day and you're like, all of a sudden you do kind of get worried. It's like, okay, great. You know, we're making money, but at the same time, what's happening behind the scenes that I,
right.
It's almost like too good to be true after you've had right. just your ass beat in for the last, whatever, like
four. Exactly. Years, like the miners, mm-hmm. Can you imagine? Miners are up 85%, 100%. Can you imagine having been beat to death on miners for 10 years and have them 100% and you say, what's wrong? Yep. Something's wrong.
Something's
like
wrong.
I could just. The PTSD that mining, I mean, I was a PTSD mining owner at one time. But no, that's actually a really valid point, because I was between the horns of a dilemma. The market was telling me something was going on, and that something was either the end of the world,
yeah.
right? Or nothing. And if I couldn't find anything, and it wasn't the end of the world, and I couldn't find anything, then it was air. And the market was going to collapse again. I wanted to find something. Show me progress coming out of China. Show me something, you know, something more that the BRICS was doing. And I got my answer. About 3 months before, you remember last year, we were all like, oh, the BIS, we're going to be Basel III, and that makes gold tier one, and that's going to be great, and that'll make gold go up. Well, no, it did. Because there's the West labeled gold as tier one, which means, and this is important, which means it frees up gold to be on a bank's balance sheet to be counted against their losses. Mm-hmm. So tier one capital means I have a gold bar, it's worth $100, or I have an ounce of gold, whatever it is, $4,000 it's called. I have $4,000 worth of gold. And now I can actually count it as $4,000 on my balance sheet. And
right.
therefore, I don't have as many losses. So it's like, you know, you're marking to market your gold. And everyone was like, that was it. And I was like, oh, that's great. That means they'll never sell gold again. They don't have to sell it to raise the cash. They just, right. I have the physical gold. I don't have to sell it. In the old days, it was when it was tier three, you had a $4,000 an ounce of gold on your balance sheet, $4,000. And you were only allowed to count $2,000. So if you wanted to unlock the $2,000, what'd you do? You sold it. You just sold it. So, and I've actually been in that situation. So now the banks are like, it's tier one. We don't have to sell it anymore. And that's one of the reasons that gold rallied. And then a report comes out of London. And the report is gold's not HQLA. Now, I wasn't that familiar with HQLA at the time. But HQLA is basically... It's one thing to be tier one. Your gold is worth what it's worth. But it's a piggy bank. You're not allowed to lend it, sell it, or use it. the financial market in the world is basically a repo market. And repo is, I use collateral to borrow money from you. You give me the money and I build my roads with it. And most people have their, most countries have their money predominantly in treasuries, between 50 and 70%. That's a wide berth there. Let's call it 60% of all the collateral that's used for building things in the world is treasuries, U.S. treasuries. So I'm a poor country, but I have treasuries. And I go to China and I say, I want you to build an airport for me. Or China's going to build it. I'm an African country, right? I give them my treasuries for collateral. Why? Because treasuries are what's called HQLA, high quality liquid asset. It's a title, it's a label. But once something's HQLA, it's then repoable, repurchase agreement. I'm not going to get to what repo means, but basically, once it becomes HQLA, it can be, it's suitable collateral to be used. So it goes from being a tier one piggy bank to something that I can use and bring to the repo pawn shop and borrow money against.
Yeah.
That, and the word is that unlocks the value. The value's here, but it's locked. When you unlock the value of gold, what do? Well, all of a sudden that poor African country with all that gold can now use the gold to get currency from China to build the airports, to build the roads, to build the ports, and you're unlocking wealth. You know, I have a Joe DiMaggio rookie card. If Joe DiMaggio, and it's worth, let's say, $1 million. I mean, I don't have it, but so what can I get for it? Well, I could probably get $1 million, but I have to sell it. But what if I could go to the repo window and say, here's my Joe DiMaggio card. And they said, oh, here's $1 million. And they just gave it to me. I could finance building my highway with my Joe DiMaggio card. And so gold is now, if it were to be HQLA, gold would be completely unlocked to compete with treasuries. And if you're a country that has any problems with the USA at all, it's like, I don't want to, I'm China. I don't want to accept US treasuries for collateral because of what they did to Russia. I would rather accept gold. So now we go back to this thing that comes out of Europe and says, gold is not HQLA. And I go, not HQLA. All right. So they're kind of keeping it on the balance sheet. They're not going to use it. And I put it in my back pocket. And then I started seeing some behaviors in China. And long story short, I've bored you with all the other stuff. Long story short is gold is being accumulated in one of the Shanghai exchanges, the futures exchange. We can get into the differential. Gabby, another time with Eric, and we'll talk about the differences. But Hong Kong opened its Shanghai vault. I mean, it's in Hong Kong, but it's part of the Shanghai network, which is what I described in May. China is connecting all the vaults. You can put your gold in the vault, and your gold can sit in the vault, and you can see it, and then you can borrow against it. And so Hong Kong joined the network. And then almost overnight, not overnight, but relatively soon, the Shanghai Futures Exchange gold warrant started to explode. And that means there's a lot more gold that's being claimed over there. And it went from, you know, 4 to 40, from 4 to 60, from 4 to 70 kilograms. And you don't do that on an exchange unless you're going to do something with the metal. And once I realized that HQLA means something could be used for repo, I started asking around. And I had a conversation with a couple of people. One of them was Eric. And I'm like, if Hong Kong's part of the vault system now, and Shanghai International, SGEI, is going to be feeding that vault system, could they be doing something with that? And he asked a couple of people, and we looked at a couple of things. And the answer is, I got the answer, right? Back to the whole point. Either it's the end of the world, right? Or it's nothing and gold's going to drop. And the answer is, I believe, and I wrote on this, I believe that I know that China's ultimate plan for gold is to let it be fully monetized so people can unlock its buying power and build their countries back. That's what the BRICS want. I have gold. I'd like to build my country with it. Why do I have to convert it into dollars? And so China's like, and I don't want treasuries. I want gold. So I'm going to make it HQLA. I'm going to allow you to pledge your gold I'm going to lend you yuan and you're going to build your country with it. And I went, that's it. That's it. That's the answer. So as of right now, so tying it all together, the European Union said gold's not H2LA. They were being defensive, protecting themselves. And China is treating it like HQLA. And when they get their vault network set up, gold's going to be a repoable asset. And the world's market share of gold will go from, of treasuries will go from 70%, 60% down to 40%. Meaning people will start, look, if you want to do business with China, they would prefer gold. Mm-hmm. I don't want to take American Express. I'll take Visa. I'll take the gold card, right?
Right.
And so all those BRICS countries have gold since the beginning of time. What happens if you're in the West? Well, if you want to do some business with China, maybe you need to have your gold up front too. We can't do that. We can't say that because if you do that, you're using your gold to compete with your treasuries and people will start dumping treasuries. It's really bad if we do that. And so I went, oh, that's why we repatriated the gold. I had that confirmed. We started repatriating the gold because we knew China was moving. I mean, confirmed, it's still conjecture at best. Confirmed that we started repatriating gold at the end of the year. I won't say the source. He'll reveal himself later on. We started repatriating the gold at the end of the year through the first quarter because we got wind that China was going to escalate their behavior with gold and seek to make it HQLA, a repoable asset. Technological term aside, China was going to make people start to sell treasuries. And so we had to bring more gold back. Maybe it was the gold we don't have. You know, maybe it's the empty vaults. Maybe we're buying a little bit more. I don't know. So I became comfortable being long, right? Mm-hmm. So I went from being, oh my God, it's the end of the world, and or this doesn't make sense, I should get out, to, oh, China's back on track. And China has escalated their plans, as my friend said. And the U.S. is screwing up a little bit. And the U.S. is reacting to cover ground. And so after a million words, I'm saying to you that the U.S. is in trouble. And if we have a recession, here's the conclusion for the U.S. If we have a recession, we are fucked. That's it. Mm-hmm. We can't have, and that's why Trump's going to cut rates. And that's why gold's going to go up. And that's why it's going to go closer and closer and start looking at M2 money supply instead of whatever we're valuing at now. So I hope I didn't put anyone to sleep on that one.
Well, again, I think it's useful to walk through how you think about these things. And I think, you know, a big piece, because, you know, you used to be an oil guy, Vince, when we, let's say, consider if you're thinking that it's the end of the world, do you ever look at the oil price? And I want to separate out oil prices afterwards, but do you ever look at the oil price to kind of confirm or put another piece into that calculus?
That was a big problem. You know, trained in oil and gold back in the 90s and 00s, I was like, oh, and you wake up in the morning and gold is up. You say, where's the dollar? The dollar's up. Well, if gold and the dollar are up, then somebody's unhappy and there's a flight to safety. All right. What blew up in the Middle East? I don't know. Let's see if oil's up. And if oil's up, you're like, all right, somebody got bombed, right? If oil's not up, you say, that doesn't make sense. Mm-hmm. Something's going on in Europe. So over the years, that became the tie-in. If gold is up, look at the dollar. Is the dollar up? Then there's a problem. Where's the problem? Well, is oil up? If oil's up, then the Middle East is blowing up. And if it's not, then Europe is blowing up. That was my morning ritual. Check these three commodities. Check these three assets. Mm-hmm. And then, without going into the whole thing, the oil mechanism for Middle East unrest broke. You know, we oil rallied during the October 7th war, and everyone was talking when the Gaza war started, and oil did rally with the concerns about Iran and the Strait of Hormuz, but I happen to know a lot about that, the Strait of Hormuz, and that was only because I was schooled by the late, great Peter Buttel, who understood the geopolitics of oil. Like, no, he knew where the gun turrets were, you know, in the Strait of Hormuz. He's like, that one points that way. You're not going to get past, like, tremendous. And what he said to me back then was, you know, the Strait of Hormuz doesn't get blocked. If it does, Iran gets nuked. That's basically it. Saudi Arabia would want it to be nuked. Israel would want it to be nuked. We would want to be nuked. Iran's gone. So anyway, and I was saying, well, everyone's really talking about the Strait of Hormuz, but oil's not really moving the way it should, given the crisis. I mean, I've seen oil move a lot more, even under Biden, you know? And so when you look at that, the decoupling of oil to gold, something that Luke Grumman talks about sometimes too, from a different point of view, I'm like, what is gold now? Is gold the new oil? I mean, and so when gold rallies for that oil, I get nervous. But I'm no longer nervous because we want the price of oil down, and that's all part of the deal that we cut with the Saudis. So that's it. Gold's on its own now, and I'm happy with that.
So directly in that, though, Vince, if we need oil lower, like that obviously contributes to that idea that you kind of brought up about the U.S. not being able to withstand a recession. Is right. that signaling mechanism of oil now broken?
You mean signaling mechanism for the Middle East?
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it's broken. It's broken somewhat, or put it this way.
Or as a warning of more geopolitical tension being priced into that market.
You know, the signal has really undergone a change. And I don't know that it's permanent, but that's where it is right now. And here's what I mean. When we were getting along well with the Saudis, like perfectly well after the first Iraqi war, when they had a problem, this was the deal that we had with it. Saudi Aramco is basically American technology and Saudi ownership. And we'd say, all right, we're going to go in and we're going to put down this uprising, whether it be Iran or whoever, and we're going to stop this. But we need you to pump oil before we go in because we don't want the oil price to spike, which will hurt our stock market and inflation. Mm-hmm. And so the Saudis would go like this. They'd hit a button, bing, and oil would just be flowing before the war started. And oil would drop from $29 to $15, something like that. And then we go in and we invade. It's like Iraqi one. And it would go up to $29 overnight. It was unchanged after the whole thing. So the deal was, we protect the Saudis for oil, which we want. They pump when we need it. We're security guards. They pay us with cheap oil. It's that simple, right? And that worked for years. And then under Biden, it went south because we started picking fights with them because of green energy or whatever you want to call it. But it was foolish. Even if it was intentional, it was foolish because we empowered OPEC for almost 4 years. Now, Trump goes back to that. He may be talking tough with everyone, but he hasn't talked tough with the Saudis because he cut a deal. He's the first bilateral deal we cut. We went in there and we said, stop selling treasuries, please. Stop selling, we'll sell you our jets cheaper. We cut a deal, and it's a great deal for everyone because it's an easy deal. The Saudis hated American shale because it cut into their market share. But we all know in the oil business that Saudis are low-cost producers of oil. So if the price of oil goes to, I'm making a number up, but it's really not that far off, $13, they're still making money. Mm-hmm. No one else is, though. So the Saudis' cost of production is $13. I'm making it up, but I'm not that far off. Iran's is, let's say, $20. And the OPEC relationship is based on no one cheating. Iran, we're going to pump this amount. And the Saudis say, fine. Then the price of oil goes up and everyone makes more money. But then Iran starts to cheat and the Saudis go, you can't cheat. And they pump more and the price goes to $13 and no one's making money except for the Saudis. The U.S. likes that. And Trump understands that. He went to the Saudis and said, how'd you like to have more market share of oil? Pump more oil. I'm going to cut a deal with Russia. They're going to pump more oil. The price of oil is going to go down. We're all going to be happy. All of your competitors will be priced out of the market. And we're going to sell you jets cheap. Just don't sell treasuries anymore. That's my impression of what he did. And I think that's why you don't hear OPEC in the news complaining about our president anymore. That was, I think, a real gem in the crown. We did with Saudis and the UAE. Now, they're going to invest $600 billion. I don't think that's going to happen, but they said it, so they're going to invest something. That's a good sign. And what that did was, to come back to what you said, it breaks a signal that was already being managed. Like we would always pump oil and the oil would go up. We let it go up. But what's happened was, I think the word got out to the bigger players that oil is not going to be allowed to rally at all anymore. Started with Biden, the SPR. The SPR killed it for speculators in oil. And so they said, all right, what's moving? And they went, oh, let's go to gold. And so maybe oil should be bought, but the signal is broken, as you noted, as you smartly noted. And, you know, I think oil will go up when it's too late now. You know, we really need cheap oil. See, part of the American thing is, if the world has cheap energy, we believe that we, and our Canadian brothers and sisters, we believe that we will take that oil and make something great with it at a better rate than another country. Now, that may or may not be true, but the point is, cheap energy helps us stay out of a recession. Mm-hmm. And that's where we are.
So, Vince, are there other oil prices through the world? Like, obviously, you know, there's the Alberta price for oil. There's Brent crude. I don't know what the, let's say, the Saudi pricing name is, but like, are there other oil prices that maybe still have some of that signal built into it over, let's say, Brent price?
Well, that's actually, you'd have to have an oil person who's on the physical side on that. I mean, I understand it, but I don't know what to look for exactly, but it goes like this. Your point is extremely valid. WTI, American oil, is not as important as Brent oil. It wasn't always like that. Brent oil is the standard by which all oils are measured now. It's the most used. But really what happens is when they price oil, they price it in a basket. And the basket is, I'm making it up, 50% Brent, 10% WTI, 20% Saudi, you know, 20% Nigerian sweet, whatever. I mean, there's a basket, right? And yep. All the nations fight over how much of their oil is in the basket. By the way, we had WTI raised because we wanted to control price a little bit more. So that's what we do. And the thing that you would look at to keep this really short is you would say, all right, if WTI is not reacting, is there another oil that would give me a better barometer? And the answer is yes. You would have to look at what's called a basis trade. So what's oil over here versus oil over there? Right. But for a normal person, look at gasoline and look at diesel. Because oil production is important, but when a refinery is blown up, that's bigger. So if there's unrest, let's say there's bombs being dropped near my oil refinery and oil production facility in the Saudi Peninsula, I'm going to turn them off before the bombs hit. And that's where you see where the fear is. So if you're looking for a better discounter of global unrest, you'd want to look at refined products versus oil. Now, there are other people out there who have a little bit more experience at the physical side or oil. Maybe Doomberg would be one of those, and Bryn Kelly would be one of those. I think for me, when things were going crazy, when Biden was hammering oil with the SPR, I just looked at the crack spreads. If the gasoline was up and the oil was down, I'm like, well, it's refining capacity. Like, we have plenty of oil, but we can't use it for anything. So I think you want to look at diesel, heating oil, and gasoline prices. If you want to look for, every time there was a problem, gasoline prices spiked, even though oil stayed down. That's because we can't pump gasoline as easily as we pump oil. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it makes sense. And I think it's interesting to you know, consider that those signals within the market, and to figure out if there's something, as you say, that can kind of take that place. But you mentioned earlier, Vince, this idea that the U.S. really can't withstand a recession, let's say. Right. But, you know, the Fed has cut rates. We're, you know, they're still in this era of QT. You would think that they have room to be able to have some monetary leeway if we do get into a recession. So that kind of makes me think that we're in this era where we would much prefer inflation over any type of a market correction. Why can't the U.S. stand a recession right now? Or is it more of a conscious choice on Trump's part?
No, I think it's a conscious choice. I think it's a conscious choice. I mean, there's a couple of different questions there. So let me think about this. First of all, in the 90s and O's, 80s, 90s and O's, monetary policy was more important than fiscal policy. Fiscal policy was not spending. Think about Reagan, shrinking government, all those type of things, you know, spending less on welfare. And monetary policy was opening the spigot. And so monetary policy determined. And I think a lot of people, ourselves included, and speaking for myself, think of monetary policy and the Fed as the most important thing. It's not, we're not in that era anymore. We're in the era where the fiscal side, the government side, is the spending side. It's the gas pedal. And the Fed is the brakes. So during the 80s, 90s, and O's, it's the government spending less and the Fed printing more. Now, post-COVID, it's the government spending more, like the 70s and 60s, and the Fed printing less. Mm-hmm. There's a balance there. And so if I'm Powell, and let's say that I think I'm doing a good job, I'm sure he thinks he's doing a good job, I say, okay, the fiscal side is very loose. And they're going to, like, look, the One Big Beautiful Bill Act, however you want to call it, in that bill, in that act, Trump did something that they did in the 70s. He said to every company that manufactures, if you buy an asset, let's say an airplane or a truck, and that asset is depreciable over 20 years, I'll let you depreciate all of it in year one. So you spend $1 billion on airplanes, and your earnings don't go down by $1 billion. And so stocks started to pump. And it's against those, this is the key to what you're implying. It's against the higher implied valuations that the US will build its economy on. So to put it simply, the US has stock valuations that are too high, and now it knows it, or it's admitting it. And it recognizes now that its real economy must catch up with the valuations. And so we can't afford a misstep, because a misstep can be a cascade. So Trump is saying, Trump's inner voice maybe is this. It's like, yeah, I know I'm putting my feet on the gas, but we can't afford a recession now, man. We can't. Because if our stocks falter, then our capital markets freeze. If our capital markets freeze, then everyone takes their money out of stocks, puts it into gold, maybe some treasuries, and we're done. And our stock market gets cut in half. Our 401ks drop. You got a generation of people who won't have money for Social Security. It's a disaster. Mm-hmm. So we need to keep the bubble inflating. We need to keep pumping it up. And so he's saying to Powell, cut rates, would you? And Powell's like, no, I'm not going to do that. And you know, maybe he's going to start cutting more now. I don't know. But we can't have a recession because we have a stock market that's been too high for too long. And now we need the real economy to catch up. So the stock market is saying, we're going to be a great economy in 2050. And we're saying, well, we've got to get up to 2050 tomorrow. And that's why we're pulling manufacturing. And a real example your listeners would, I think, appreciate is watch all the data centers that are being built. The mm-hmm. data centers that are being built are, this is what you hear. So-and-so is going to sink $1 billion into data centers over the next 10 years, over the next 20 years. And you start looking at these projections, Zero Hedge was like all over this. You start looking at these projections and it's like, okay, we're going to spend $5 billion in data centers over the next 5 years. And we project that our earnings will go up by this amount over the next 5 years. Okay, that's normal. Now we're at the point where I'm going to spend $300 billion over the next 50 years, and we're going to project our earnings are going to be at infinity. So everyone's going, go further out on the curve. It's going to be great. And so the further you get over your skis or out on the curve or however you want to describe it, the more risky you are. So what I'm seeing, and I think other people who understand the credit markets better than me are seeing, is that companies are more and more recognizing that we can't afford a recession. They're getting comfortable going further and further out on the curve, like the NVIDIA stuff. Oh, we're going to have, you know, and the Zero Hedge statement would be like, well, I guess we won't have a recession for the next 30 years. You know, I mean, and I'm like, yeah, that's the point. We can't afford to have a recession. And so to come back to your main point, inflation over recession. Every time, Tom. But it doesn't mean I don't look for the reason for inflation over recession. And I just explained it to you. Inflation over recession. We need to not have a recession that the rest of the world doesn't have. So either it's going to be COVID-26, where everyone has a recession and we all reset again, or we're going to have a bubble and force everyone to compete with us. That's it. Inflation over recession. Because the alternative isn't recession. That's bad enough. The alternative is stagflation. See, when we're already buying all this stuff to build, and if we stop buying it because we don't have any money, prices are going to come down because everyone else is doing okay. Mm-hmm. But we have a lot further to fall. Yeah, it's inflation over recession. And so even though it's not the 1970s with everybody getting their welfare checks, at least not yet, maybe it'll be again, even though we're not spending money on a welfare state, we are spending money. And it's always inflation over recession. The person who comes after Powell, though maybe gold's just going up because the person who comes after Powell is going to be a lunatic, you know, and just print money coming out of their ass. I don't know, but it's inflation over, look, inflation, the inflation 2% target has been abandoned. I mean, it'll never be officially abandoned, but you heard it here first. It was abandoned at the last Fed meeting when he said he's ignoring the FAIT rules, which was the average inflation target. And it's even come out of the FT. 3% is the new 2%, because 5% or 6% could be the new 4% unemployment. Mm-hmm. So it's all going up. It's like, you know, there's a seesaw, inflation versus unemployment, and you try and balance them out. What happens when the fulcrum gets raised? The whole thing is higher now. It's like 3%, 4%, 3%, 5%, 6%, 10%. We can't afford a recession because the fulcrum is the world, and the world is changing.
Right. So, Vince, in that inflationary landscape, what are the assets that you, or what are the things that you need to own that are going to keep you, let's say, keep your head above water financially? You know, in some ways, we can. I know you've talked about this recently, that Bitcoin was really a sponge for much of the liquidity that we've seen over the last 10, right, 15 years here. What are other assets? And I mean, Bitcoin probably does belong in that bucket, that people need to own in that case to somewhat be able to, let's say, appreciate alongside the inflation that we're going to be experiencing, if this is the playbook for the next at least 3 years, 4 years.
Well, okay, that's a good question. Let me just start with the plain vanilla. Stocks. I want to start with stocks. Everyone has stocks. I think it's important to say that. If you believe there are one of two paths for us to go on down the road, barring another COVID event, one path is we successfully inflate while raising our productivity. So you have inflation, but you have real productivity gains, and we have a great economy. That's Goldilocks returning, right? So we have 5% inflation for a couple of years, but our GDP just climbs and we reinvent the wheel and all these good things happen. That's one path. The other path is we get stagflation. We keep printing because we have to, but for some reason it doesn't work and the economy goes to crap, but the price of things stay up. So in the first scenario, the Goldilocks return scenario, you would want to own, in the equity side, small caps, innovative companies, and you would want to be, you would say, I'm less interested in owning Apple, I'm more interested in owning the next Apple, right? You're willing to take that risk. You're also in that category, you also want to own manufacturers and miners, you know, which is what you're seeing happen now. You don't want to own service industries. You don't want to own pharmaceuticals. You don't want to own utilities. You don't want to own those things. So you're looking at a good bubble. That's a good bubble, right? If it goes south on the equity side, you just like don't want to own any equities except maybe for miners and maybe at that point some utilities. I don't know. But that's the whole point. The point is your portfolio should be, and I'm paraphrasing Hartnett here, your portfolio should be a barbell. It should be on one end of the barbell. So one end of the barbell is your profits. And that's your Mag 7, right? And the other end of the barbell is either going to be where we go to from the Mag 7. If things are going well, you buy smaller stocks because they'll go up. Russell 2000, right? Mm-hmm. If you think we're going to have stagflation from the Mag 7, you buy gold. You buy miners. You buy inflation sponges. Bitcoin, I think, is going to be in that category going forward. Right now, it doesn't feel like it, but it's trading over 110,000. So that's it. So that's the general idea. The general idea is if the path is going to be success or failure, then you want to own stocks and gold, stocks and miners, stocks and energy companies, not producers, refiners. And then you want to own stocks and small stocks as a hedge for that. You just don't want to own bonds in those cases. Maybe you do. I don't know. I don't think so. Because I think yield curve control is coming. Now, with regards to the sponge concept, that's an interesting word that you used. Remember the Richard Werner interview with Tucker Carlson?
Yep.
During the Richard Werner interview with Tucker Carlson, he was talking about many things, Japan, QE, and the definition of money as bankers really perceive it. And it's funny because, you know, basically the meme from that was bankers, not just central bankers, regular bankers print money out of thin air. Mm-hmm. And I got curious because I had read something a long time ago and I kind of dismissed it. It was a Bank of England report and was talking about how bankers, it was like the rare honest report. Bankers print money out of thin air. Not just central bankers, bankers. Mm-hmm. I had read that and said, this is goofy. Like it was over my head. I was like, who cares, right? I went back and I looked at it and it said everything that he said. And then, you know, goofy reader that I am, I started searching for more stuff on it. And it turns out David Graeber, the deceased anarchist, read it too. And he said, I looked for other papers written by these people after that. He goes, and they were nowhere to be found. He's definitely a conspiracy theory on the left guy. He's like, they were nowhere to be found. So it looks to me, his quote was, it looks to me they accidentally were honest and they were never allowed to talk about it again. And then boom, Richard Werner comes up and I go, oh shit. So I start looking for bubbles. And you don't need me to tell you. I mean, I'm going to tell you, but all you have to do is pull up a chart, right? The Fed is a bubble machine. Mm-hmm. And it's not like they intend to make bubbles. I'm giving them the benefit of the doubt. What they do is the government sees a part of the economy it wants to rescue or prop up. It needs equity valuations to go up. And what does it do? It prints money. And when they print the money, it goes out, but you're rising the tide for the whole country. And so some of that money is going to go to the stocks that you want, to the part of the economy that you want. Some of it's going to go to gold. Some of it's going to go to the price of eggs. And so the government, this is like, I'm very confident, the government uses market structure to steer the money away from gold. It's a tier three asset. Put it in stocks, put it in GLD, don't put it in gold. So it steers money. They're kind of rerouting the plumbing. Capital controls that are not called capital controls. And that's what happened in QE. Print a shit ton of money and just make sure it goes here. And there are ways they do that. Raise reserve requirements, lower reserve requirements, tell them gold causes cancer, whatever you want to do. But they did these things, right? It's the American version of being China. And that worked. This time it's not working, you know? All right. So then it just kind of revealed itself to me that when they have this extra liquidity sloshing around that they don't want to go into gold, they encourage you to go into something else. So I'll give you real examples of this. If you were to plot the stock market and the housing market, meaning money in stocks versus money in housing, you would see that the housing market peaks in 2000 as a percentage of individual balance sheets. And then as it goes down, it's almost simultaneous. The housing market goes up. So, and I remember this, the stock market bubble is pierced and the government starts making it easier to own a home. Ninja loans are born. All these things are happening and banks have a new way to make money. And so everyone's a homeowner. So they just ported the bubble from the stock market.com to the housing market. Mm-hmm. And then in 08, that collapses. And you would say to me, or maybe one of your listeners would say to me, well, where's the bubble after 08? The bubble is the Fed's balance sheet. The Fed bought all those bonds and all those stocks, and they absorbed all the housing bonds, and they absorbed all the mortgage bonds, and the Fed now has a balance sheet. Now, you said we're in QT. So my pushback is, we're never going to unload that balance sheet. Mm-hmm. Never. That's the bubble that must remain, because if we unload it, treasuries go to zero. So the first bubble, 99 to 2000, stocks implode. The housing bubble, 2000 to 2000, and you could see it going up, 2000, 2008. Housing bubble crashes. The Fed rescues it. Isn't it interesting that in 2009, Bitcoin is born? It's almost like, right? I'm a fan of Bitcoin, but I still don't think it's completely an organic thing. Yeah, some guy just created Bitcoin and said, yeah, here, you can have it. I'm a nice guy. Like, no one did that. But, you know, I think that the Fed, in recognizing its need to create, what's the word you use, sponges, liquidity sponges, to sop up the excess, whether it created Bitcoin or not, said, yeah, that's a good place. And so Bitcoin just grows on its own organically. It just happens, right? People are aware of it. Then people start getting nervous after COVID, and the government says, we need a sponge. But Bitcoin is really too powerful. We can't have it be that big of a sponge. We need to make it an equity. And so the ETFs were made. And so the U.S. pricing power comes in, U.S. control. And so it's a regulated crypto now. It's a regulated, I mean, it's still, I know all the hardcore guys, it's still on, yeah, I know. We can't steal from you, but there's on-ramps and off-ramps. And if 50% of the world isn't able to use it, that's going to be a problem for you. You know, so what I'm saying is, I know that they've done this, because this is what they did with gold. You take the asset that you have no control over, you adopt it, like when they created gold futures, you list it, you let people buy it, you trap them in it, and you let them die. That's, that's not going to happen with Bitcoin, but that's what happened with gold after the 70s. It's explicitly stated in a WikiLeaks email. We're going to start a futures exchange to dampen the upside volatility in gold. It's like almost word for word. And that's what they did with Bitcoin. So, but now gold's going up again. So now we're talking about, what is the other sponge? The other sponge is gold. Mm-hmm. For some reason, this goes back to me being depressed that day. For some reason, gold is being allowed to go up. Where's the pushback? Nobody's pushing back on gold anymore. There's no one out there saying, you know, the milkshake guys, no disrespect, but the milkshake guys are like, you know, where are the Neo-Keynesians? Who I have a big disdain for, saying, well, it's tied to the dollar. No, it's not tied to the dollar. It's tied to the money, but it's not tied to the dollar. And where's the pushback? I mean, Bloomberg's headline yesterday was phenomenal, unbelievable headline. Bloomberg, Neo-Keynesian, hates gold, has no revenue stream off of gold, has no gold advertisers. Headline, gold hits $1 trillion valuation. And then proceeds to talk about how a revaluation of gold will reduce the deficit. I went, what's going on here? So I think, little by little, the U.S. government has said, let's pretend that they're agreeing with me. This is right. We can't have a recession. We got to keep printing the shit out of money. We need Powell to lower rates. We got to have an off-ramp or a sponge to soak that shit up. And you know what? Gold doesn't look good for the dollar, but Bitcoin looks worse. Let's dive in gold, because at least people aren't going out and buying coins. I mean, they are, but it's not like the 70s that most of the normies are putting it into GLD. And where is that money? That's in the US. It's on shore. It's not China. It's not Shanghai. It's not leaving the country. I believe that gold is being remonetized begrudgingly by the US as a sponge. Look, if I have $1,000 extra dollars and I put it in gold, that's me not going out and hoarding eggs or hoarding canned foods. Mm-hmm. That literally will keep inflation down to an extent, as long as they don't start talking about it as an inflationary predictor, which is what it is. So I believe that gold has been redeputized, that's the word, redeputized as a permitted inflationary sponge. I mean, come on, how is Bitcoin not up? Bitcoin is the new gold. Bitcoin's gold 2.0. Every time a corporation buys $1 trillion in Bitcoin, they also sell $1 trillion in Bitcoin futures and they keep a lid on it. Bullshit. It's what they did with gold. So gold is being permitted to go up. And the kicker is, the reason I think this is true, aside from just being an opinion, I'm talking my book, is because we're on the outside looking at China monetizing gold, HQLA, repo. And the US is like, well, we want to build those roads in Africa. Then maybe we got to take gold for collateral. Let's make sure we got it. Anyway, that's it. Stable coins are going to be part of that too. We talked about that as well. Yeah.
Well, I mean, from your description, it's almost like gold is now Bitcoin 2.0.
You know, that's funny.
First, yeah.
Yeah. Gold, attach it to a stable coin, and gold is Bitcoin 2.0. In fact, didn't we see an article in the FT? It might have been the FT. It's such a ridiculous article, but we all commented about it. But it was funny. It was like gold is the all natural Bitcoin. Something like, did you see that?
Or organic Bitcoin.
That's it. Organic Bitcoin. Gold is where, and I went, wait, is this a woke article? You know, it wasn't. It was like, gold is organic Bitcoin. I'm like, who says that? You know? But yeah. Gold is Bitcoin 2.0, you know, Bitgold or whatever.
Vince, when you mentioned that stablecoins are going to be part of that, how big do you think that market can actually be? You know, like, I know the stablecoin issuers are mandated or legislated to have to buy US treasuries now. Mm-hmm. So, you know, what is the actual size of debt that can be absorbed by that stablecoin market, considering, you know, what the actual, let's say, depth or breadth of that market is actually going to be?
Right, right. I don't have a number handy. I mean, I have to look at it, but the numbers are going to be like this. If you want to have a proxy for the numbers, how much of our debt is outstanding, how much foreign money comes into the US, and those are your proxies. So we're talking in the multiple trillions of dollars, like call it 17 trillion, something like that. And the reason it works, well, let me just say this. It would 100% work if this was 2012. It would 100% work if this was 2008. Because what Trump and the stablecoin people are doing is they're saying, I mean, I know it's a painted turd, okay? But to all your, but I know it's a painted turd, but it's our painted turd. So just listen. If I am the US and I need to stem people from selling treasuries, and I also want them to invest in US companies, that's something we're doing now, foreign direct investment, FDI, I've been talking about that a lot. Wouldn't it be cool? And this is real. Wouldn't it be cool if I didn't even have to have them sell their treasuries to buy stocks? That's what everyone loves about stablecoin. See, stablecoin, I mean, I could be wrong. I don't know, but I don't think I'm wrong. But the thing about it is, if you want to use treasuries to buy stocks, then on paper, you have to sell the treasuries and buy the stocks. The stablecoin becomes the money that you buy the stock with. Mm-hmm. The stablecoin is the guaranteed contract, the non-fungible token, if you will, that says this has $1 billion in treasuries in it. And that is used as cash. It makes the treasury a no-sale asset that can be used to buy. So when you say to the Saudis, please don't sell your treasuries, they say, why? Well, we want you to invest in the US. Well, I don't want to, you know, use treasuries in the US. Fine. Then you can put the treasuries into a stablecoin. You won't have to sell. It's actually a kind of a money laundering scheme when you think about it. Hey, all that money you got from beheading all those people, well, you can just put it in the US, just put it in a stablecoin. It'll be laundered. I mean, I'm joking, but I guess maybe I'm not. So what it does is it takes a day out of the lag and it makes the digital dollar, the central bank digital currency, be owned by different companies. The JP Morgan stablecoin, the Bank of America stablecoin, it's an outsourced central bank digital currency. And the reason that it would work in 2000 and 08 and even 12 up to 16 is because, and this is key, I don't have to go on a rabbit hole here, This is key. The world did what we wanted them to do, even reluctantly. You know, in 2012, after QE had been underway, China spoke with Obama and said, "We are concerned that you're printing too much money. This QE is going to hurt our treasuries." And back then, the U.S. could say, "Whatever, don't worry about it." Mm-hmm. And they towed the line. When's the last time you ever heard Russia, China, Brazil, India, and even Saudi Arabia, big, relatively big economies, simultaneously saying no? You wouldn't. They'd be worried about being bombed tomorrow. Like, I mean, I'm joking, but I'm not. Like, there is that threat of force that we carried, and we were just good enough, just benevolent enough to be said, okay, well, at least they won't steal our treasuries. And now that's changed.
Right.
So now, this stablecoin idea launched in 2000, 2008, 2012 would have been like, hey, that's pretty cool. We'll do that. We get to invest in your country more. Now it's like, now what do you have? You have Russia pushing back, saying, publicly pushing back, saying, well, the U.S. is basically going to put everything in a stablecoin, and then they're going to devalue the dollar. And you know what? He ain't wrong. Mm-hmm. That's how you do it. That's monetization. That's happening right now. We're monetizing our debt. Now, the flip side of that is I've been noticing that I'm hearing a lot less in any media from Russia coming to me. Like, the information I was getting from China, sites I can no longer get into, I feel like we're being put into an information bubble. I mean, maybe we're not being censored and dragged off to the gulag like they are in the UK, but we're in an information bubble now. I think we're being censored. And mm-hmm. and because of that, I think when Trump comes out and says, Russia's stupid, I don't think they're hearing it in Russia. And I don't think we're hearing what they're saying about us anymore. I mean, at all. I think the free press is done, except for if you know where to look. And I think all that said, I think we need to get stablecoins in everyone's hands before Russia and China poison everyone to it. And so that becomes a race. Saudi Arabia, use stablecoins. Well, China's going to do the gold thing. Okay, well, we'll split it with you. I could just see the negotiations turning ugly on that. So I think stablecoins have a potential of a massive market share, and certainly, they will be a force. But I think we're, like the government always does, oh, this will bail us out. Let's park our money in the new bubble. What will the new bubble be? Stablecoins, right? And so it's kind of like the government has a toolkit right now. You know, it's like we need to have owners of treasuries. We can make the U.S. people buy them. We'll do that through stablecoins. We can make other countries stop selling them. We'll do that through stablecoins. We can have people put money in Bitcoin. That's cool. That's, you know, use stablecoins for Bitcoin. And you know what? Let's throw gold in there too. Just as long as it doesn't leave the country, we're okay with that. But I mean, that's completely speculation in my opinion. But I think the stablecoin thing is not an easy road to hoe. And simply put, if you're in real estate, you understand this. Stablecoins are a new shopping mall, and you need to get anchor tenants in your new shopping mall, the Gap, the Apple, whoever, right? And that's what Trump's doing. Saudis, do you want part? Yes. UAE, do you want part? Yes. South Korea,
no, everyone's in that system.
Right, right. And now you've got these stores here, and now you go to the US and you say, here's the Gap, here's Apple, and the US will just make it real. You make the network work. And all these deals that Trump is cutting, even if they're sincere, I don't think they are, I think if you wait 2 years, those deals are going to collapse. That's why I'm saying own some stablecoins, own some Bitcoin, but have them be a hedge for the gold that you buy. That's where I am.
So Vince, of course, you know, as we're kind of speaking here, we're about 38.50 on gold, and you know, over 46.50 on silver. Do you think there's any significance to the fact that now silver is higher than what the gold value or the treasury values their gold at on the balance sheet?
You gave me a softball question here. You stole my graphic. So I woke up the other day, and silver was like, I have a buddy on Twitter who has these GIFs of or GIFs, however you say it, of the number 46, 47, 45, and he's been feeding them to me. His handle is at those hands. And it's like this woman who's surprised, and the hot pink color, and the number 40. So it's all very G-rated. But I woke up, you know, my alarm went off because silver was over 47, and I posted it. I go back to bed, and I wake up again. Jordan, Roy Byrne, the Daily Gold guy, who I do a monthly show with, and I have a lot of fun with him, great technician. He posts something. He goes, something like, isn't it interesting how silver's trading at a higher price than the price we carry gold on our balance sheet at? And I was like, oh, that's wonderful to say, right? And so I ran with it. Of course, I cited him. But if you're trying to make the case to revalue gold in front of a bunch of mediocre intelligence congressmen that are interested in keeping their jobs, you got to give them something to hang their hat on. Mm-hmm. And so when you say to them, the price of gold is only $42.22 on our balance sheet. The price of silver is $46, $47. We need to revalue gold. We need a reality check here. And so I think that's a significant mile marker for anyone who wants to revalue. Look, you got Bloomberg talking about revaluation. You've got banks talking about revaluation. You've got the price of silver higher than the price of gold on our balance sheet. We're going to revalue. I mean, I'm betting on it. My position's betting on it. We're going to revalue gold, and it will make the price go even higher.
Just from a like a confidence and a demand standpoint?
Oh, no. Let's say gold's trading 3,800, mm-hmm. right? And let's say we revalue gold. First of all, we're going to revalue to five. No, we're not going to revalue to $5,000. That's stupid. I mean, if we did it, it would be stupid. It would be like make the dollar go to zero, unless we're backing the dollar with gold. Let's say we revalue it to 2,500. As it goes to 2,500, that instills confidence in more and more companies to hold it. More and more. It's not on its way down, it's on its way up, you know? So let's say I'm a bank in Europe, and let's say they revalue it too. Well, if I buy gold, it's going to be on my balance sheet at the higher price. I can afford to buy even more now, that type of stuff. The revaluation of gold, for that simple reason, instills confidence. To resummarize what you said, it instills confidence. But here's the other thing. There are two paths from there after we revalue gold. If we revalue gold explicitly to retire debt, as the Constitution says, you can revalue gold and you can hedge it or sell it to retire debt explicitly. You can't sell the gold unless you're retiring debt. That would be bullish for the dollar and bearish for gold. Mm-hmm. And maybe we will do that. Part of me wants that to happen as a proud American. The other part of me says, oh, 1971, we revalued it. What did we do? Did we sell it? No. Did we hedge it? No. Did we retire debt? No. We just erased the number and put a number there and spent the money. So I think that's what we're going to do. We're going to erase the number, put another number there, and we'll spend most of the money. And that will be the reason gold goes up more. Mm-hmm. You follow?
Yeah.
Like in 1971, we revalued gold in 71, and then we had the oil embargo and stagflation right after that. And that was it. It was over. So once you raid the piggy bank, you can't raid it again.
Mm-hmm. Well, Vince, I really appreciate you walking us through all these ideas. Is there anything that you'd like to leave our listeners to think about before we wrap up here?
No. I think you've let me run with it today. I appreciate that, and I hope everyone got a lot out of it as much as I did. So, thank you for having me.
Of course, always a pleasure, Vince. And let us know if there's anything, any questions you have, or anything that you'd like us to cover next time. Of course, all of Vince's work is available at VBL Goldfix on Substack. There's a ton of information. I don't know how you do it, how you put out that much stuff, but it's all excellent stuff. And of course, on X as well, at Soren the K. Vince, thanks so much, man.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.